bring a little more depth to the document. The first is that one of the people that drafted this final copy is Jack Nelson Pallmeyer, who is a Lutheran pastor in Minnesota. We've had him out to Denver to speak to us. A very courageous man. He's very much, he's written books such as War on the Poor, writes about low-intensity conflict, which is what, you know, kind of the form of oppression that the United States inflicts on third world countries such as Haiti in order to keep them in line, you know, kind of an oversimplistic view, but keeps these countries in line so that basically U.S. or northern multinationals can operate more cheaply in those countries. And so Jack Nelson Pallmeyer has done a lot of exposing of U.S. policies that enable that system to continue. He's a very courageous man for having done this. He exposes United States covert policies that any one of us just have no idea what our government is doing, you know, covertly, that affects all of us as well as people, you know, in oppressed parts of the world. And it's kind of funny because when you see Jack, he looks like he belongs on the ski slopes at Aspen. I mean, he's just like Mr. Pretty Boy. He's got this gorgeous hair and very nice face. And he looks so harmless. And he's doing this research. You know, he's exposing things that our government does. In a way, he's Coyote. You know, he's cutting the heart out. And so anyway, he came to mind because the second paragraph of the document talks about the risk involved in this shift. The risk involved in true kairos, and the risk involved in if we really did declare a jubilee. And Jack told us that one time, I asked him, you know, have you ever been at risk for doing this? And he said one time he spoke about low-intensity conflict to a kind of a mixed group of military and conservatives and liberals, and there was a general on the panel, and after Jack spoke, the general turned to him when the microphones were off, and the general turned to Jack and said, you're a dead man. Just a general in the United States military said to a civilian, you're a dead man because you do this. So that, you know, the risk, I think, has to be taken very seriously. And we can talk a little bit more about that. It is risk unto death, I think, to make this change. And death of lifestyle, perhaps personal death, in order to carry this out, because there will be enemies for trying to do this project. Two short stories about my son that I think illustrate the effect this will have on future generations. And again, risk is an important part of this that we have to face. It's a mixed bag. As Martin said, it's saint and sinner. It's, you know, it's not all just one thing. The price for children, I think, will be high because it will mean that they are the generation that is relearning. They are the generation that is revisioning, and they are the generation that will have to live out of that new vision. And it will be painful, I think. My son went to a preschool where they did the little Indian projects. You know, they did a lot of the little Indian projects. And so I always keep everything he does. And I don't know how this particular project ended up in his projects box without comment. It must have just somehow gotten thrown in there. I never saw it. But Tink and I were sitting with him one day, and he reached down in the box and he pulled out on this stick, it was a shriveled apple core. And he had been told by his teacher to take the shriveled apple core, draw a face on it, put black yarn on it for hair and a feather. This was an Indian. And it was ugly. It was really ugly. And so he pulled it out and the look on his face, I mean, Tink and I were sitting there and he just looked at Tink and he looked at me and I saw the shame. My son was ashamed of something that he had been instructed to do by adults. He had been instructed by adults that this is an Indian, and he was to make this. And so it took a lot of talking to him to say, Tom, you didn't do that. You know, you were following your directions, and you know better, and we've taught you, and you know Indians, and you know that Indians don't look that way, and you know that's disrespectful. You know, this was several years later. He was in grade school when he pulled this thing out and we had this experience. But it hurt him deeply that he realized, you know, that he had participated, even at his young age. The second story, I think, is more frightening on a systemic level. In 1991, in Denver, we were kind of gearing up for the quincentenary, and there are been this escalating pattern of the Federation of Italian Americans putting on this Columbus Day parade in Denver, and then the Indian community in Denver and supporters of the Indian community protesting this. And it was really building up to this crescendo for the quincentenary. So 1991 was kind of a crucial year. And we succeeded in stopping the parade. And that was the morning's actions. And I had vowed to myself that my son wasn't going to be a part of the morning's actions because it may have been violent. And so he was six at the time, and it just wasn't right yet for him. You know, his time will come to do that when he can start making those choices. So, but I did want to take him to the afternoon event, which was music and food and kind of, you know, we were successful in stopping the parade. And of course, the press had a heyday of really, you know, hanging us up as fascists for doing it. But we did it, and did it nonviolently. So that afternoon I took my son down to the Civic Center, and there is this notorious statue in Denver, the Columbus statue in Denver. It's very abstract. You wouldn't even know it was Columbus, except it has this plaque that says the miracle of 1492, and it's a great sort of celebration of this supposed miracle of Columbus and all of that. And it's been also the site of several protests. Russell Means has defaced it publicly. And so I wanted my son to see that. That's a part of the history that I wanted him to learn. And I thought that at six he was ready to go see that. And I could read him the plaque and say, Tom, this is a lie. And you might as well know unfortunately there are people in the world who are leaders who lie. And so Tink and I left the celebration up at the Capitol and took him down to Civic Center Park. Now this is a bit of a walk. And there's sidewalks, and there's like a plaza, and there's cement, and there's grass. And we didn't know we were being followed, but we were. So here's Tink and I with a six-year-old going down to the Columbus statue, walk into the plaza, and stand at the statue, and I'm reading to Tom, you know, the plaque. In 1492, there was this miracle in it. Tom, there was no miracle. It was when Indians got killed by this man. And Tink says, we're being watched. And I turned around, and there was a police car that had jumped the curb. It followed us all the way down, jumped the curb, jumped the grass, come up on the plaza, and it was filled with four SWAT policemen in full gear. Because I and Tink and a six-year-old were a threat to the system. And I turned around, and I stared at them, and I yelled, as I'm prone to do. I said, for God's sake, I'm with my son. You know, meaning as if they thought I was going to blow it up or something, you know, with my six-year-old there. I said, for God's sake, I'm with my son. So they turned and they circled around, but they kept watching us. And I turned around again, and I said, after all, I'm teaching him your history. And then there was some snide remark, I guess, and then they left. But you see, that is how far this fight will have to go, is that children, I think, we have to think of the kids. We can't back off from the struggle and the challenge, but we have to remember that it is the future generations. You know, we're starting the project, and the future generations will carry it through, and it's not going to be easy. So I wanted to bring that up. The second paragraph of the document talks about risk, and I wanted to unpack a little bit about what risk might mean.
I'll try to be brief. Coyote is us, and I'm glad, for whatever that means, and I'll have to figure it out, because my reaction, of course, is being conflicted, too. Most of my reaction is probably second and third hand. One of my mentors was Andrew Schulze, who experienced the piss out of Coyote's penis in a jail in Birmingham as the policeman urinated all over him because he stood with Martin. And a man who wrote of our relationship, positive relationship with blacks in 1940, long before even the Supreme Court or anybody else thought about it. kind and gentle man, and I'm glad to have been touched by him, even though I'm nowhere near the Birmingham jail. Another distant mentor was my orthopedic surgeon in Chicago Heights, Illinois, which led me into activism in behalf of peace and justice in all kinds of absolutely tiny ways. But because when he wanted to build his house on the wrong side of town, they burned it down. And then some of us, including police by force, watched the house for 24 hours a day for, I think it was 10 months, while the house was rebuilt. And as an orthopedic surgeon, he didn't send bills. So the feds got him, because he didn't pay his fed tax either. And they put him away, and he died at a penitentiary in Minnesota. And literally, I saw the package. Thousands of letters were written in his behalf and sent to the Congress to explain that this was not an evil man, but he was a black man, and he had stood up against the system. He was killed by our government in Minnesota. So the cost and the risk is really, really heavy. I want to do more. I've considered giving up flying. I want to do something where I see myself doing something I haven't done. With my kids, I have stopped buying things for my grandchildren. I think older people could do one heck of a lot of stuff if I stop buying things for grandchildren. Hmm. Grandchildren got more than they need ever. I mean, to pick on them, that means stop buying for ourselves as well. It'd be pretty hard to get along with my grandchildren if I don't buy them something, if I'm buying me something. One of the things that scared me about the document and reviewed it again, I hadn't looked at it for months, was seeing those, all those organizations, and I know at least 15 people on that list, and I know some of those organizations, and a lot of them are two-bit operations. I felt good about that. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I felt good about that because I think maybe through that kind of an approach, the seed idea, something might happen. And sometimes I feel like I've been at this doggone long, I'm tired, but on the other hand, I feel I haven't done a blooming thing, and therefore I want to, and I want to do it, I suppose, with somebodies, so that there'll be a sneaky idea, if you pardon me saying this, that my grandkids will suffer. Because I'm afraid they won't. And along with Martin, I'm going to be a sinner and a saint in the midst of it all. I know. But we better go on well. Keep starting these conversations. I'm grateful to Tim for doing it here.
Just one quick response before I invite you home. When I say that it's the system that we have to pay attention to, I'm perfectly clear that I'm a part of the system. I work at Iliff School of Theology, and our constituency is the United Methodist Church and the Captains of Industry in Colorado. Mm-hmm. and the United Methodist Church gets its money from the captains of industry in the South and in the East Coast. We're part of the system that we're talking about.
Yeah, that's for me, Martin, is one element of the confession part of that.
We're not talking about the enemy as them. You know, we are Coyote. Y'all's response, and the panel, feel free also to come back in.
Sorry. What are some suggestions in perpetuating this movement, implementing the movement, getting the movement going, getting the message?
Do what people here at Holden did. Start a group. Wartburg Seminary started a Kairos group. They're affiliated. They're in the list.
Mm-hmm.
Get together some people who can take this stuff seriously and make commitments to be a part of this movement, to be in conversation with all the groups that are listed at the back of the Kairos document. I mean, that list should be 10 times bigger than it is. There are no institutions there, and this is not an institution. This is a movement. But the movement counts upon each one of us working at a grassroots level. That's what comes to mind, at least, Sarkoan, off the top of my head.
The other actions that I have seen connected with using the document and around the quincentenary and this kind of idea of shifting, our view or vision of the world, was also things among young parents about, being willing to challenge school systems on how they were teaching our children.
Mm-hmm.
And again, you pay a price. I've gotten phone calls from my son's teachers about, why is he saying this in my classroom and he shouldn't be. I've tried to do workshops for faculty, for elementary and junior and high school faculty, on a document that came out about this same time, Dangerous Memories. Did anybody hear of that?
Mm-hmm.
Expands on what's in the Kairos document as far as giving you a good overview of the history that's being talked about and how we arrived at this system in the first place. But I'll tell you that it's been a mixed review from those faculty, that the teachers are not entirely willing to give up coloring the three little ships for Columbus Day, and it's a difficult process. But I would say among young parents, anybody interested in education, to start continually bringing this to the attention of those involved in educating the young. And it's tiresome. I mean, I can plan on it every year in October. I'm going to end up at my son's school, and they know who I am, and they're getting tired of me, but I'm not going to stop. So that is one suggestion that I've made is to just always be, presenting the alternative, or the true material. To not be afraid of doing that in whatever forum that you see available. And that the Kairos document, I think, could be, because it is ecumenical, it's more broad-based, and could be used as a resource. I always want to have something in hand, to mm-hmm. hand to somebody to mm-hmm. say, I'm not just the only person saying this. And you may want to look at this.
I think that support is really crucial. I think so often when you go in and you talk to your children's teachers, and as each individual parent does that type of thing, you feel like you start to feel like you're the only one.
Mm-hmm. And they treat you like you're the only one.
Yeah, really, yes. And you also feel that way if that continues. And so belonging to an organization or a group that is dealing with these issues, whatever that is, whether it's a church organization, it's a Kairos document discussion group, whatever it is, I think is real important so that you are a part of something and you don't always feel that you're out there all alone doing this kind of stuff, because we had the same kinds of experiences. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't until I found a group where I felt some support, that it was able, I felt better about being able to continue. Mm-hmm. You know, I think we all, that's part of what this is about. Mm-hmm. And then get other ideas. Mm-hmm. I think that's real important, to find mm-hmm. other people who are like-minded or at least move that direction.
That's why grassroots movement is important. Other comments?
In your author.
No, go ahead, Paul. I'm just I'm getting a shooting order lined up here. He's next after you.
In your introduction to the document, which I'm going to take back to my church, and I'm going to introduce the people and get started, so I respect and appreciate what's there. You mentioned, I felt anyway, with the kind of trivializing and the disparaging when you're talking about groups that focused on Namibia or focused on El Salvador or focused on something. And my response to that is that in my own profession, I'm a teacher, I can't know all of my specialty is African American literature, and I pay a lot of attention to that. And in the process of that, I feel I'm making steps towards a different vision about the American system. I feel that I'm making steps, and nobody has to tell me how much part of the sinner I am. I know that. But I get a little bit of glimpse of sainthood when I see a new vision occur in a classroom. And I guess I don't want to trivialize my work, or I wouldn't want anybody here in the attempts to their steps that they would take to try to address the incredible complex issues that are here, that our small steps are trivial. And that because if we think that, we're going to look at this and we are going to be paralyzed. It is so big, and I'll never forget standing on a ramp in South Africa looking out at Kalichi, this town that I looked, every, as far as I could see, was incredible poverty. And I thought, and this is just, and the lady next to me said, this is just section B. Well, what can I do when I look at section B of Kalichi, a black council near Cape Town? And I said to myself, yeah, I haven't been to New Mexico, and I haven't been to Mexico City. I haven't, and I rattled off all the cities that are in incredible poverty too. My whole point is, our small steps, I think, matter, and the little bit of sainthood we can glimpse in the midst of our incredible sinner status, we have to hold on to, I think, and I don't want to have to trivialize that for myself or have anybody else with you.
Trivializing wasn't my agenda at all. Linking what we do into a systemic whole is my agenda, because I have the things that I do too, right, in the midst of all of that, because I can't do all those different things.
Yeah.
But we have to somehow link them so that we understand that we're not going to change the world by changing U.S. policy towards El Salvador. Because as soon as we got, finally, some shift in U.S. policy in El Salvador, it gets haywire somewhere else in the world. So that changing that one little policy is something we can work towards, but we better be under no illusion that that's going to change the world. We've got to somehow approach that same one particular problem with a much more systemic sense of change that's necessary. Tell me your name.
Tim. I had a real question. Where's the document? How can I get a hold
of it? Can we circulate the document?
Yeah, there's two copies in the Resource Center right here. This
is one of them.
The next room.
On the left. There are two copies that should stay in there. You know, people can read it, but as long as they leave it in there. But also Pax Christi is distributing it.
On the back cover, the bottom line to order Pax Christi USA, and there's an address. And then if we can circulate that.
I mean, I'll write it up here.
Oh, that'd be good.
Okay.
348 East 5th Street.
It's a C-R-C-H.
C-H.
All right. Yeah.
348 East 10th Street. Erie, Pennsylvania.
Other comments?
16503.
I did want to respond to Paul to what you're saying, because I think what you're raising is an important point. I've just had the experience of serving on some boards of groups, you know, justice and peace groups in Denver, that we've come up against some real challenges as far as trying to make decisions about focus, what the focus of the group will be. One of them, the Denver Justice and Peace Committee, had very consciously chosen Central America as its area of focus, but it invited me on the board as someone who could talk about the Caribbean, because they knew that they had to link Latin American issues with Caribbean issues. You know, otherwise they weren't going to be getting as broad a base as they needed. But also the issue of funding is critical right now, because it seems that these small groups you were talking about, a lot of those groups in the back being, you know, very small operations, are coming up against like this huge machine of, there's no funding available. Mm-hmm. And now there are so many of these groups, and we all get, you know, flooded with these appeal letters from all these groups, and all these causes are so worthwhile. So it is a very real, I think, dilemma, you know, because I wanted to be on that board, on all the boards that I served on. In Denver, I ended up having to cut back and just be on American Friends Service Committee, because they were dealing with more kind of broad-based things that I could address being an international studies person. But I agree. I mean, I think you have to choose where you're going to devote your energy and do well at it. You know, you want to devote, you don't want to get so scattered that you're not paying enough attention to do, you know, to be able to say something articulate about that area. But what I do find, and I'm sure what you find in what you do, is that what you're applying to your area has currency in all these other areas as well. So you know, in that sense, I think that it's worthwhile to certainly delve deeply into one area. I wish I could be Jack Nelson Palmyre. I don't know how the man does it.
That's great.
You know, how does he go around and do this research and get this information? I wish we all could be Jack Nelson Palmyre, but yeah. Or someone like that. But, you know, if we do well at the thing that we choose, then I think, again, those issues are going to transfer pretty easily. So.
Other comments, please.
As an elementary school teacher, a little different level than Paul does, that concept of keeping the whole in mind while you're working on those individual areas that you can tackle is really important. And then also seeing those people that are working on those areas and giving some support to them. Because as a member of the faculty of 20 or so teachers, some of us on that faculty are supportive of changing those visions, giving information to the children and doing it in different ways. Some of them don't care, and some of them are opposed, even among the staff. And then once you bring it to the kids, they come back with the other vision or various versions of that from their parents and from their families and their communities. And they say, well, wait a minute, you can't do this. They told me that was wrong. And you all of a sudden, you're trying to keep this vision in mind, and you're getting shot at so much for one small spot.
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly.
That it's very difficult to keep going. So those people need support and some energy provided to them as they're trying to put out some of that stuff.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah.
Anybody else? Jim?
I think it would be good for us to talk more sometime, somehow. I don't know how to organize it. How does the system on an information level, on the sharing of things, how does it keep doing this? In other words, I guess I want to talk a little bit about this whole issue of how to be involved in a group. Somebody described, if you're just involved in a small group like that and that's all you do, it's not so good. But if that's your way of focusing, and that's the way of learning, I'll just give my own personal experiences. When I went to Phoenix, I really didn't know much about how to organize the grassroots and how to deal with issues, although I had a lot of the sort of passion that seems to be there in that document. But what I learned in the sanctuary movement was kind of how to organize and how to get groups going and tackling things. And then all of a sudden, when this war came in Iraq, there were a whole bunch of us that saw all the signs of how propaganda works in Iraq. I had been reading books about a year before that about how propaganda works. And it was textbook. It was down the line. And one of the things, just to show you how it was so much textbook, was that Jacques Ellul, who did this big study of propaganda, said that in order for propaganda to work, it needs to be at all levels. In other words, it needs to be in the print media, it needs to be people having conversations, it needs to be on the electronic media, it needs to be on people's t-shirts and things like that. And within a period of 2 or 3 weeks, all those media systems were in use, plus many more. And if I had not had that experience in working in the Central America thing, I wouldn't have been able to recognize that in the Iraq.
That's right.
And so one of the things that seems to be a problem is that compartmentalization in our society is bad in the sense that we can't move from Central America to Iraq kind of thing. But we could take advantage of it in that if we really focus, we can probably learn in a very focused area. In other words, that's how I learned the nuts and bolts of how, when we got to, it's just that we can't forget that this is going on in every area of life or something, I don't know. Mm-hmm.
Another thing that I've tried to do to sort of, I have to find all sorts of creative ways to rejuvenate myself, to get mad all over again, I guess. You know, what I have to have experiential things to do that. And one thing I've done are just simple little, like field trips to places where the oppression is actually being manufactured. One example is our NORAD in Colorado, North American Aerospace Defense Command, is in Cheyenne Mountain. And I went on their tour. And it was just, you know, a simple little thing. You call ahead of time, you go, it's free. And boy, I came out of there kicking and screaming. You know, I mean, I was outraged. I just happened to pick up a book in Nevada. Now this is all sort of military stuff, but in Nevada, these bombing ranges, I've mentioned them before. And I mean, I just didn't know. I knew it went on. I knew that there was the Nevada test site. I didn't know about these bombing ranges and the low-flying, you know, planes and how it's destroying people's lives and destroying sacred sites and it was a photo. It was a photo book that showed me the undetonated bombs that are lying around and the toxic pools and craters that are there in Nevada. And I, when we were coming out here, I actually told Tink I wanted to drive through there. I mean, I wanted to be right there by one of those bombs, you know, because I need to keep, I guess, proving it to myself over and over again that this is really happening. And so I try to seek out, even if it's not my area of expertise, I don't know a whole lot about the military-industrial complex, you know, but I know that I've seen NORAD. And I know that I know, you know, that this thing exists in Nevada that maybe someday I'll go and see. But anything you can do to even sort of do a momentary foray out of your usual area of concern and just go see a place or talk to a person or go to a lecture or read a book, you know, just to remind yourself and to keep that real experiential has been another big thing to help me. It just, it just kind of keeps those fireworks going for me.
Mm-hmm. I bet if my family could see the crazy horse in the morning.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
After being to Mount Rushmore.
Oh. See, I haven't seen Mount Rushmore.
And it's an interesting experience to do that in a day.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Paul.
Just to kind of value of the specific focus is that when you talk about or teach, and we, Sandra's left and she teaches preschool, and Jeff brings them at all levels of involvement. You teach a particular subject, and the subject, or discuss a particular subject, whatever it is, whatever kind of involvement you have, the subject itself becomes the vehicle for bigger issues.
That's
when you understand the issues of justice and love and compassion with the American natives, that equates to justice and love and compassion with the slave system and the legacy of slavery. And it equates to the system of injustice in El Salvador and so on. And I know that I couldn't name more than one city in Central America, but my focus on African American history has taught me something about justice that I carry and bring to when I come across an issue or a historical piece or a newspaper article about El Salvador. Mm-hmm. I make all kinds of connections. Mm-hmm. And the value of that, I guess that's what your wonderful stories do about Coyote. Mm-hmm. They make connections that go way past this fabled title.
When we were involved, and Lauren got me involved in Haiti, after Aristide was deposed in 1991 on September 29th, it became clear to us at some point that the U.S. ambassador to Haiti, at the point when Aristide was deposed, was one of Henry Kissinger's proteges from the early 70s. Who was trained in the Kissinger doctrine of low-intensity conflict, which was honed then in Central America. Now, suddenly, Haiti becomes a part of the whole ball of wax. Aristide wasn't just deposed by the rich and powerful in Haiti. He was deposed by the U.S. government, and we still haven't come clean on that one. Now that we've reinstated Aristide in Haiti with a promise not to run for re-election next year. I mean, we're still not clean on that one. And here we're sitting in front of our TVs thinking, haven't we done something wonderful in Haiti by intervening and reinstating Aristide? No, there's a hidden agenda there, folks. There's a hidden agenda.
It got layered over, and it still is.
Yeah.
I think also what I wanted to respond to what you're saying, Paul, is that the most valuable lesson I learned from one of my professors at DU, University of Denver, in my graduate school program, my PhD program, was I was taking research design. And he said, always ask the question, because it's a human rights program we're in, always ask the question, who benefits and who gets hurt? Mm-hmm. And that's never failed me. You know, I mean, it's like the simplest research design, and I just go out with my question, who benefits and who gets hurt? And I assume that we have certain standards we can agree on, especially in the human rights field, about what's a benefit and what's getting hurt. And when I apply that question, you know, it's really amazing how it transfers to all these different areas. Mm-hmm. So it's very simple.
And I'm not sure that we can understand or complicity unless we prepare for and have some type of an immersion experience. I think that it's very important that we find a way, I think it relates to what we were talking about, that we find a way to experience mm-hmm. what's happening,
right.
To make it real to us.
Right.
So, you know, whether you take a group of people and you go someplace, the group that you're working with, or you create some kind of an immersion experience, but then debrief it appropriately and figure out how to act on it. And I'm pretty sure that we really don't understand our complicity until we start doing that.
With the recognition, too, that probably Americans are about the only ones in the world that have to create an immersion experience. Well, you know, that's the point of what you're saying. I mean, everybody else has their immersion experience, whether they want it or not. And so, you know, that's the other side that highlights the complicity issue, I think. Mm-hmm.
And I don't think we can be in solidarity with anyone until we until we can embrace that experience. I mean, we're not fixing or helping other people as we participate in trying to make these changes. It's an opportunity for us to transform ourselves. I mean, I think we have to get out of that fixing other cultures and other people mentality.
Yeah, and I think even with the immersion experience, we always have to be careful, because I've heard like these reality tours, you know, they kind of they take 12 people and trudge through, you know, some food co-op group working, and it's real offensive, you know, to have just sort of this look and see thing. You know, it has to be carefully structured and designed. And I also was thinking about my three experiences in Haiti. The first one was working with Mother Teresa's nuns. When I say that, a lot of times people say, "Oh, you did?" You know, and there's this sort of warm, fuzzy feeling about it. And it was absolutely the worst thing I ever did. I mean, it was an offense, what I did. And I, you know, I still see the faces of these people in Haiti that it was like, I didn't belong there that way. But at least I was one person that realized that and was able to kind of, you know, sort of swallow that experience and say, gee, maybe there's another way to do this. And so what I do now is when I go to Haiti, I always make it a point to play up being an American citizen and that my skin is white. And so I'm going to go to the American embassy and I'm going to smile sweetly and I'm going to say I'm an American citizen. They don't know I'm not interested in investing in Haiti, and ask, you know, gee, what are we up to? And it's amazing all the information that they just sort of, you know, come forth with. And so, but then I hand that over to Haitian human rights groups who then can design their strategy based on that. See, they can't do that. They can't go to the embassy that way. I can, but then I'm going to turn it over to them and say, here it is, run with it. So.
It's been a while since I read the document and just been glancing through it. Would you say that the Jubilee seems like if there's going to be change, we don't necessarily have to know exactly what the vision for the new is, but it seems like we at least need to kind of try to feel towards it. And is Jubilee, would you say that that's the sort of central vision of how things ought to be, or what will make things better? Or?
I think so. I think that those of us in the North, speaking now as a U.S. citizen, I'm also an Osage Nation citizen. Those of us in the North who have the responsibility for declaring the Jubilee dare not have the arrogance to think we ought to name the new vision that will replace what is. That can't be. I mean, we've had our chance, and what we've built has disenfranchised and marginalized most of the world. I think the one thing I would say is it's clear to me, and it ought to be clear to us at a theological level, and isn't in the ELCA, is that capitalism is part of the problem. And it and is, in fact, inimical to, antithetical to, anything that we know from the Gospels, from the Scriptures, and from our theology. It's Daly and Cobb, in their book on community. What's the title of it?
Common good,
thank you. Who make the point that in fact capitalism is predicated on the theological insight of the Reformation that has to do with naming what for Europeans at the time of the Reformation was human nature, the human condition. The difference is that Calvin and Luther and others saw the human condition as a negative that needed to be confessed and repented from, and capitalism sees it as a reality that has to be used and is a good, namely human greed. A system, an
You'd have to add in there some conversation about Luther's two kingdoms, wouldn't you? That there is, given human nature, perfection is not an option. And therefore, I mean, I think the argument is that if you structure human good, structure human greed, admitting its faultiness, but try and structure it to create the greatest good for the greatest number, by structuring human greed, you've tilted towards about the best human beings can do. I think that's the argument.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That assumes, of course, that greed is an inherent human condition that motivates all societies. And that may not be true.
You never got back to my question, which is, what is the human anthropology that undergirds this? Do they assume with the Reformation that every human being is both saint and sinner simultaneously? Or is there some other fundamental understanding of the human person that it undergirds this?
Now, first of all, this isn't a Lutheran document, it's an ecumenical document. Involves Catholics and Baptists, the whole range of mainline denominations. So that it's not going to be a Lutheran anthropology. But it also involves different communities of color. So that, there's been an American Indian influence, for instance. That means that, I may not be able to name for the group what the anthropology is that underlies this. I can say for myself that my own anthropology does not assume that greed is that greed as it has been defined in the West by theologies, anthropologies, and psychologies and philosophies is a human universal. In fact, I would argue that there are cultures where the common good is first and foremost on everybody's minds in the community. American Indian Aboriginal communities function that way. I'm not saying we do today, because I think colonization has introduced a virus that makes it very difficult to be whole and sane. And I don't see that as an ideal we can return to. I mean, Indian people still see, in the midst of this more or less greedless society, see the need to remind ourselves that we too can be coyote. So there's some aspect of humanness there that leaves us in tension between what Luther might call saint and sinner. No doubt about it. But I guess I would argue that we've got to strive for something better than we have. That in fact, capitalism as it is now, called the world system, and in capitalism, communism were lumped together as the world system by Emmanuel Wallerstein in the mid-70s in his three-volume classic on economic history and contemporary analysis.
I have no quarrel with that. I think we ought to do better. But I don't want us to confuse us striving for better with us creating the kingdom of God on earth. I don't think, in my understanding, that's a human possibility.
See, I approach that from a different tack entirely. I don't want to create the kingdom of God on earth. I want to recognize that it's here.
Where do you find it?
Well, here, these people out there in that tree, God made all of this. It is God's basileia. See, at that point, I am not buying into 100 years worth of biblical scholarship on the basileia of God that tends to find the basileia as a temporal entity that will happen sometime. I'm much more inclined to say it's here. We need to learn to respect, recognize it and respect it.